Good morning. Good to see you all. Sorry we're a little late. We tried to do a bunch of fixing on all the lights and things like that, and we think we did our best, but then this morning one light decided to go off and on over and over again. I think there's two reasons for that. LED lights don't just flip off, they like flicker instead, and then probably all this crazy stuff that's been going on in this room might have worn down on some of them and caused a couple issues. So we might have to change a couple bulbs the next couple weeks. I thought it best to just take it out instead of run the risk of putting something else in and it flickering all service. So at least everything stays the same. Hopefully we'll be good. If you didn't get a handout on the way in this morning, raise your hand, and we want to make sure you got one. If you didn't get a handout on the way in. Everybody has one? Excellent. No? Yes? Good. All right, Joel chapter 2. We're going to try our best to finish this passage, although I will say this. Last week I had 5 pages of notes, and this week I have 11. So the odds are a lot smaller than I would like them to be. And also we're not starting right on time, so I might just have to allow that to come by. But Joel chapter 2. Joel chapter 2 is still in the first half of the book, and the first half of the book has features that are distinct from the second half, so there's some similarity. And I hate to say this, the part we're probably not going to get to today may be the part that is the part that makes chapter 2 very distinct from the other one. But what we see in chapter 2 is this picture of being overwhelmed. We're going to read it here in the beginning. I was going to read it twice, but we don't need to read it once back to back. But a lot of overwhelmed people in our world today. Things just happen, and it gets very much to handle. And people don't really know how to deal with it. And that's why there's a lot of people that are living with anxiety, a lot of people on medications for those types of things, a lot of people who are depressed, a lot of people who are working really hard to control the world or becoming recluse because they're just trying to escape it. Life can get very overwhelming. And our response to it tends to be one of several. We sometimes ignore it. That's what a lot of people like to do. Let me just act like there's no problem and shut out the world, and hopefully it goes away. Sometimes we try to fix the immediate issue. There's a problem, and so we spend our life trying to do whack-a-mole. Something happens, and we try to handle it. Not too long ago, we watched the Mario movie. Probably nobody in this room has, but I grew up playing Mario, so I super appreciated it. But at the very beginning, Mario, he's a plumber, and he's trying to do a plumbing job. And of course, it's a classic cartoon issue where there was a plumbing problem, and so water is squirting out of the wall. And so what does he do? He puts his finger in the hole, and so it squirts out of a tile on the floor. And so he puts his finger in the hole, and then it starts to come out of the shower, and then they put their finger in the hole. And that's how life feels sometimes, doesn't it? If it's not one thing, it's another. If it's not all the lights flickering, it's that one, right? You know, if it's not one thing to deal with, it's something else. And so we just try to deal with the immediate issues. We feel like we're spending our whole life trying to tamp them down. Or you find the real source of the problem and address that. You either ignore it, you deal with the side effects, or you deal with the real problem. And a lot of us tend to have the wrong mindset, and we try to address the side effects rather than the real issue. Now, in this very short book of Joel, this prophecy, he talks about how things have been coming on Israel that were overwhelming them. The theme, the day of the Lord is a theme throughout many of the books of the prophets. In the book, and Paul, when he talks about the day of the Lord, he really refers to it as the final day, the final time of judgment where God brings all things to how they should be. And so he blesses, but he also judges. It is his day. The emphasis isn't on the effect of what he does. The emphasis is on the fact that he's the one doing it. But the book of Joel, what he does is he applies this to a variety of situations in his time and in the future to remind us that God intervenes into human history. And we saw one back in chapter 1, once a major locust plague that had come on the people of Israel that you didn't just move past. A locust plague was something that destroyed crops, destroyed the food supply. You couldn't just go on today, tomorrow as if you still had food in your pantry, because you didn't. And so the people who were expecting it to be in the grocery store, the people who were expecting it to grow, the people who were affected by it all weep and mourn. And the result of chapter 1 is they lift their eyes to the Lord. Well, in chapter 2, what we see is something very similar. He begins to use this picture of a locust plague from chapter 1 that he kind of pictures like an army coming at Israel. And what he does in chapter 2 is he talks about now an army coming against Israel, and he starts out by kind of picturing them like a locust plague. So what you see in between chapter 1 and chapter 2 is you have this picture of all these locusts flying against the city. And then as you continue to read, all those locusts turn into soldiers that are marching against the city. That's kind of the way that it's supposed to come across. And the way that he pictures these chapters, these verses, is in a way that is too difficult to handle. Look at verse number 1 as we begin. He says, "Blow ye the trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm in my holy mountain." The blowing of the trumpet was a call to attention. Often it was a call of distress, like an air raid siren. You didn't just sleep through it. Something was wrong. And he calls people to distress because of all the things that were happening. So let me give you point number 1. The reason I'm calling this the call of the day of the Lord is because of how it begins. He tells you to pay attention. The trumpet was a call to order, a call to react a certain way. And so what he does at the beginning is he basically calls us to recognize how overwhelming this is. That's number 1. The struggles of life will sometimes overwhelm us. They will sometimes overwhelm us. Have you ever watched one of those end of the world movies? And, you know, everything's going to fall apart. That's the whole movie's about. Everything's about to fall apart. And then one day, like, this tsunami comes and you're standing in the Capitol. It's always major, like, landmarks across the country where all this stuff happens. But they're standing at the Capitol and then they look over the horizon and, like, a wave of water, like, comes up over the Washington Monument. And there's nothing to do but just stand there and look at it like we're all going to die. Well, that's kind of the picture I feel when you read through chapter 2. Chapter 2, 1 through 9 is a picture of this army coming at the people. But he pictures it in a way that is too much to handle. Look at verse number 1 and 2. He talks about how vast it is. "Blow ye the trumpet in Zion, sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble. For the day of the Lord cometh. It is nigh at hand. A day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, as the morning spread upon the mountains. A great people and a strong, there hath not been ever the like, neither shall be any more after it, even to the years of many generations." He talks about this where, like, the sun goes dark. It gets gray and gloomy. And it says that they come like the morning on the mountains. That sounds like a pleasant picture, but the idea is as the rays of sun, like when they peek over the mountains, they spread over the whole land. And you can see the line that it just grows and increases and it covers the whole earth. Here he's picturing that same image, but instead of it being a good thing, he's not having the morning coming off over the horizon, but this dark cloud coming up over the horizon and spreading over the mountains just like the rays of the sun would in the morning. Do you see the picture? So it's covering the land almost as fast as the sun would rise. And this is a great army. It is strong, bigger than has ever been seen before. Very overwhelming picture. And what he does now is he compares it to fire. Verse number 3. "Fire devoureth before them. Behind them a flame burneth. The land is as the Garden of Eden before them, and behind them a desolate wilderness. Yea, and nothing shall escape them. The appearance of them is as the appearance of horses, and as horsemen so shall they run. Like the noise of chariots on the tops of mountains shall they leap, like the noise of a flame of fire that devoureth the stubble, as a strong people set in battle array." He says they're like a fire. Before the fire, there is absolute paradise, like the Garden of Eden And then after it, it's a wilderness. So everything's fine before they get there, and everything's destroyed after they're gone. He sees them as horses and chariots, an army that comes and devours like a fire devours land. My wife is from California, and so sometimes we'll go out there for Christmas or whatever, and we'll get picked up from the airport, and depending on what year it is, we'll drive by all these mountains and mountains of black because of all of the fires that are over there in California so often now. And you could just see, one year you'll go there and there's bushes on the mountains, and other years you go by there and there's nothing but ash. And he says, picture, we don't have a lot of that here, but people who do have that, they have that image in their mind where it just kills as it goes. Overwhelming. And then he talks about how it's an army that can't be stopped. Verse number 6. Before their face, the people shall be much pained. All faces shall gather blackness. It's a picture of them being in distress in reaction to how bad things are. They shall run like mighty men. They shall climb the wall like men of war. They shall march everyone on his ways, and they shall not break their ranks, neither shall one thrust another. They shall walk everyone in his path, and when they fall upon the sword, they shall not be wounded. They shall run to and fro in the city. They shall run upon the wall. They shall climb up upon the houses. They shall enter in at the windows like a thief. He's picturing this army as an almost unstoppable and an almost unnatural way. He says this army runs toward its city, and then the soldiers, he wants you to have a picture in your mind of all these soldiers running to the city and beginning to climb the walls. The wall was your fortress, your protection. And he wants you to have this picture of people clamoring up over the walls. He says that they stay in their ranks and they don't leave. So they're so organized that their military line doesn't conflict with itself. They work together so that nobody's bothering anybody else, and they run straight at the city, they climb over the walls, they climb into the city, they climb into your window. That's how the picture ends, like a thief. Very overwhelming picture, isn't it? So he starts with the horizon. You see about the horizon, everything's fine, and then you see this army coming up like the sunrise and covering the land and covering it not in light, but in darkness. And as it comes, it destroys, fire burns and destroys everything as it goes. You see all the green in front of them and you see wilderness behind them. And then they come to the city and then they climb the walls and they climb into the city and they climb into your windows. That's the picture he wants you to have in your mind. Very overwhelming. There are a few mental pictures more overwhelming than this. And that's what we fear, isn't it? Not having control. That's how life feels sometimes, isn't it? It just sweeps over, and there's nothing to do about it. He even says specifically, the sword, when they fall upon the sword, they shall not be wounded. He wants you to have a picture of somebody standing and guarding the wall and actually attacking one of the soldiers, and for some reason he doesn't fall. They just keep coming. Life overwhelms us sometimes. It stops for nothing. It can't be stopped, it feels like, and it doesn't care about leaving you personal space. It devours life, and it's harder than anything that you've ever known. And sometimes, whatever it might be, sometimes it is the war. People have to go through war, they feel very out of control. Sometimes it's health issues in your life. Sometimes it's the bills. Sometimes it's family issues, family struggles, or issues at work. Sometimes it's things that happen in your life, and sometimes it's things that happen in the whole world. But here he gives this super overwhelming picture. But what he wants to do, number two, is this. When we're overwhelmed, we need to recognize God's hand in it all. We need to recognize God's hand in it all. This is not a perfunctory point. The natural tendency when life overwhelms us is to try to handle the situation ourselves. Or just try to get past it. War. What's the result? When we have war, what do we try to do? We want to win the war, so we get the right amount of soldiers, we get the right kind of equipment, we elect the right leaders who are going to make the right kinds of decisions so that we win the war. When we have health issues, what do? We get the right doctor, we take the right medicine, we exercise in the right way. We'll move past this. We have bills we can't pay, so we need to just look at our finances and figure them out, or maybe we need to figure out a way to make more money. We have family issues, so we read a self-help book, we go to therapy, we understand the psychology of the issues. We have work issues. We find out how not to get disrespected at work and stand up for ourselves and understand the bylaws of our work so that we can make sure the system works to our benefit. None of those things are wrong. But I just want us to recognize how often our tendency is we become, you know, Mario in the bathroom where the water's spouting out of the walls, and so we just spend our life plugging the holes, right? Our immediate response when life overwhelms us is all horizontal, where we say, oh no, what do? Let's figure out how to fix it and make it go away. The problem is, ultimately, our issue is not that we've lost control because we were supposed to be in control. That's our tendency, isn't it? We feel like life is outside of our control. We think that we are solely responsible to be in control more again. The reason life is so overwhelming is because I've lost control, because ultimately I'm in control. But the thing is, we're not in control. God is in control. And so sometimes God brings us to a situation that is so overwhelming that at some point we have to acknowledge that we're not in control. Put yourself in this city with these soldiers clamoring over the horizon, up your walls, down into your city, and into your windows. What are you going to do? The answer is you don't know. So sometimes God brings you to this place where you're like, I don't know. So you remember that we're supposed to, like last week, look up. By the way, our fellows are coming by. Take your attendance slip and drop it in. We'd appreciate that. Throughout this whole chapter, one of the things this chapter does is he reminds you of God's involvement in this whole thing. So we read that, and what do we think of? All we're thinking about is the army. How do we stop it? How do we respond? What do we do? What do we do with our family? But what this passage actually does is he tells you to see this army in light of God's control over it. But that's not how we read it. We only read it in light of how we're supposed to respond. That's our natural tendency, especially adults. Things happen. We have a family. Guys, we're the head of the household. We have to fix it. And immediately we're wondering, what are we going to do? But what this passage tells you to do is see it in light of God's throne. That's how it begins. Verse number 1, blow ye the trumpet in Zion and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord cometh. It is nigh at hand. This army is God's day, not their day. And that's what he begins it with. For example, I gave you these passages. I won't read them all, but the day of darkness and gloominess, that's a stock image for God's work in judgment. I gave you a passage in the book of Jeremiah where he says, God works and so everything is dark. The image of devouring fire, that's the image of God's work and God's judgment used throughout the Bible. When he descended on the mountain, on Mount Sinai, we saw him as a devouring fire, he says in Exodus 24. In Psalm 97, it says, the fire goes before him and burneth up his enemies round about. That's a picture of his work. But what he does next is he changes the image from my city, my town, my life, and then he just explodes it to the whole world. We just finished verse number 9. Look at verse number 10. The earth shall quake before them. The heavens shall tremble. The sun and the moon shall be dark, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. Well, that's different, isn't it? We were just in a field with a city. Now we're talking about the constellations and the solar system. We just really escalated that really quickly, didn't we? We read past that because it just seems so Bible-ish. The sun and the moon shall go dark. But we were just talking about a single spot. Now we're talking about the sun going dark. This is common language for when everything in my life is falling apart. Now, one day, the sun and the moon will go dark, and the stars will not shine again, all together. But he uses this picture all the way throughout the prophets. I gave you a passage in Isaiah 13 where it does this. The stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened and is going forth. The moon shall not cause her light to shine. Later on, therefore, I will shake the heavens. The earth shall remove out of her place. The wrath of the Lord of hosts, the day of his fierce anger. Their whole world is crumbling around them. And he pictures it as literally the whole world crumbling around them. Why is everything falling apart? Everything, like everything falling apart. It's really easy for us to say, because of the army, because of this thing in my life. That's why everything's falling apart. But he bookends it to remind us of where it's coming from. Verse 11. The Lord shall utter his voice before his army, for his camp is very great, for he is strong that executeth his word. For the day of the Lord is great and very terrible. Who can abide it? I didn't give you the passage, but in the book of Jeremiah, when the Babylonian army comes, God reminds the people of Israel the Babylonian army was his army. I mean, they weren't worshiping God. They weren't righteous people. In no way could they be considered representatives of God, except for the fact that God was in control of when they were victorious and when they weren't. In fact, that's actually Habakkuk's issue. We're going to get to there in a while enough. We'll get there eventually, but that's actually Habakkuk's problem. Habakkuk's like, what do you mean you're going to judge Israel with Babylon? Like, aren't they worse? Shouldn't they be judged, you know, first? But the problem is, we're under the impression that God's only allowed to use certain things so we can trace what he's going to do and what he's not going to. And then when he's just concerned about us at the moment and we're trying to count scores, and see this army, well, the army shouldn't be from God because they're not good enough to be from God. That's not the point. The point is God is in control of the situation. And so in verse number one, he says, the day of the Lord is at hand. And then he goes through this whole picture of the army coming against the people of Israel. And then in verse number 11, he says, the day of the Lord is at hand. He bookends it by reminding you whose day it is. It's God's day. The day of the Lord shows up five times in the book of Joel. Each major event in the book is reminded to be God working. The point of the book of Joel is the things that we experience in life, especially the big things, we have to remember this is God's hand in my life, not just the apparent circumstances that just happen to surround me. Because that's how we view it, isn't it? Well, I guess we'll have to deal with things. But we have to remember God's hand in it. This is God's army. And so our response has to be to look to him. Dwayne Garrett says, when Yahweh moves, Joel asserts, the old order is inverted, and the familiar disappears. False security collapses. No one can withstand that day because there is nothing left to stand on. Was the locust the cause of their distress? Was the army the careful? We will try to stamp down the effects of the problem rather than recognize that God is in charge of the world. A couple weeks ago, I was preaching on Sunday night, and I was preaching from the letter of Jesus to the Church of Philadelphia, the only letter in Revelation 2-3 where he doesn't rebuke them for anything. He tells them, he encourages them. And he begins the letter by saying, Jesus is the one that has the keys of David, who opens doors and no man can shut it, and shuts doors and no man can open it. And throughout, he talks about the world. He talks about those who are oppressing them. He talks about them. And throughout that whole letter, he reminds them of a very simple principle. We can't, and the world can't, ultimately shut doors that God has opened. And we can't, and the world can't, open doors that God has shut. Because he's in control. And so when things are happening in this world and we say, oh, we need to stop them, we have to remind ourselves that people can only do, and this world can only move, and the major armies can only win where God allows them to. And so he finishes this and says, this is my army. We often think that it's our responsibility to fix the world when really it's our responsibility to acknowledge him. The world is not your problem. Your money is not your problem. Your family is not your enemy, and your job is not your issue. God is behind the work of your life. Now, the big part of this passage is verse 12 through 17, and we are not going to get to that. So I'm going to have to stop here soon. But I want you to see one last thing before we get to verse 11. I know that wasn't a great message, but it's very similar to chapter 1 where he starts and he says, when we see the things happening in life, we're supposed to look up. So I'll give you the beginning of point number 3 here in just a second. But I want you to see the last phrase of verse number 11. Verse number 11, he asks a question. In verse number 11, the Lord shall utter his voice before his army. His camp is very great. He is strong that executeth his word. For the day of the Lord is great and very terrible. Who can abide it? Who can abide it? Now, we just assume the answer to that question is nobody. I mean, when the sun doesn't shine and the stars fall, nobody. But we also know the answer to the question is somebody, because there's always people on the other end of the story. This is actually very, very similar to something that we see in the book of Revelation. Almost as if Revelation is quoting Joel, and it very well might be. In Revelation chapter 6, this is the very first chapter that judgments happen on the world. Jesus is responsible to bring all things back to the way that should be, to make all things new. Revelation chapter 5, he's worthy to open the book because he is the Redeemer. But when he opens the book, things don't just flourish into this Garden of Eden. When he opens the seals of the book, the old has to be deconstructed before the new can be reconstructed. And so what he shows here throughout the middle of the book is not the new heaven and new earth, but it's the destruction of the old one. And by the way, that's a reminder to us. We don't get to just make our lives better. We might have to take some things down and change them before they build up again. We just want our lives to fix tomorrow. We want to stay exactly the same. We want Jesus to come and reign on this earth exactly how it is instead of allow him to make it different than what it is. But what happens in Revelation chapter 6 is as the seals are broken, judgment pours out on the earth and it gets worse and worse and worse and famine and war. And then you get to the very last verse of chapter 6 and he asks almost an identical question. Day of his wrath is come. Who shall be able to stand? We assume that it's a rhetorical question that means nobody, but that's not the answer to the question. Who does stand? And the very next thing you do, we're so quick to rip the book apart and take 7 away from 6. But the very next thing that happens is in chapter 7, he introduces you to a group of people. A group of people who are living on the earth at that time who are willing to be followers and disciples of Jesus Christ. That's the very next thing that happens after he asks the question, who can stand? So look at it. I think I gave it to you. Is it in your notes? Okay. Verse number 1 of chapter 7. After these things, I saw 4 angels standing on the 4 corners of the earth, holding the 4 winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, or on any tree. And by the way, just remember, you just finished chapter 6 where everything's falling apart. Now suddenly you have a bunch of angels holding back everything so it doesn't fall apart. I saw another angel ascending from the east having the seal of the living God, and he cried with a loud voice to the 4 angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. We're introduced to a group of people for the first time in the book. People who are living on an earth that is falling apart, who choose to be identified with Jesus Christ, in spite of how bad it will be, as we will read in the pages ahead, in spite of how much persecution and pushback and pressure there will be. In chapter 13, we're introduced to the great beast that deceives the world and requires that you're sealed on your forehead or your right hand, not with Jesus, but with him, so that you can buy and sell and live life. And he says, but here, let me introduce you to a group of people who chose not to follow that way and chose to follow me instead, to turn from their wicked ways and turn to me. They can stand when life falls apart. Joel asks the same question. Who can stand when everything's falling apart around you and is overwhelming? I want us to read the section, and I'm going to give you the point, and we're going to have to stop, and I'll give it to you next week, because this is really the thrust of this passage. Everybody separates verse 12 through 17 from the first half, but that's the second part of this whole passage that goes together. Let me give you point number three. The fundamental way that we recognize God's hand in the trials of life is by turning to him during them. How do I recognize God's hand in the trial of my life? I turn to him. That's how I do so. See, if chapter one, what he does is he tells you to acknowledge him. And now chapter two, what he's going to do is tell us to, with our hearts and our hands, turn to him. Verse number 12, let's read the passage and then we'll have to stop. Therefore also now saith the Lord, turn ye even to me with all your heart, with fasting, with weeping, and with mourning. Rend your heart and not your garments, and turn unto the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and of great kindness, and repenteth him of the evil. Who knoweth if he will return and repent and leave a blessing behind him, even a meat offering and a drink offering unto the Lord your God? Blow ye the trumpet in Zion, sanctify a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the people, sanctify the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children and those that suck the breasts, till the bridegroom go forth of his chamber and bride out of her closet. Let the priests, the ministers of the Lord, weep before the porch and the altar, and let them say, spare thy people, O Lord, and give not thine heritage to reproach, that the heathen should rule over them. Wherefore should they say among the people, where is their God? Who can stand? And he says, turn to me. So what is your reaction to life? I'll have to stop it at that. Is our reaction to life like whack-a-mole? Life comes, it overwhelms us, and the way we respond is, I'm gonna fix all my problems myself all day long. It's fine to be responsible. You know, if you have money issues, evaluate if you're wasting your money and do it better. If you have health issues, go to the doctor and take the medication that they give you. You know, it's when pray for our leaders and pray that they make the right decisions and vote. All that's fine. But a lot of us, we think the overwhelmingness of life is in our hands to solve. Instead of say, this is God's day because God's doing his thing. And instead of turning to him, we just turn in on ourselves. The response to the overwhelmingness of life is to turn to Christ. And so we're going to see that next week for basically half of my sermon that I have left. And so we're going to look at verse 12 through 17. I do want you to know this for the sake of saying it, that as we've been walking through the book of Joel, and as we finish off as well, I'm going to be following the pattern that basically everybody agrees is the structure of the book. So chapter 1 is really the first point, and chapter 2, verse 1 through 17, really is the second point. The part that we're leaving for next week is really like the second point of the second point, so we're following the structure very, very cleanly. So I want you to pay attention to that as we go along. But I'm looking forward to next week. Next week is going to be very instructive to all of us, and so plan to be here for it. And as you see life this week, ask yourself how you view it. Do you see God in it, or do you just see the problems that need to be solved? And as you see God in it, that should elicit a response in us. So we're going to look at that next week.